genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
You are listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock live here on KKZZ AM 1400. Or you can hear us streaming over the internet, brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, well, you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is NPR done right. And as always, if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and as I said in the second hour, our theme is sharing information. All Sportscasters Hall of Fame as well. We'll discuss lessons he learned from Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry from his book, Giants. My third guest is a communications expert, communicates the virtues of digital technology to an entire group of technophobes. She'll help us catch up with the latest gadgets and gizmos from her book, The Digital Mindset. And if you want to join in the conversation for any of my guests, you can always call us at 639-0008. My first guest, Jim Murphy, is known for his engaging and carefully researched nonfiction for young readers. He has more than 35 books, including two Newbery Honors books. And in case you don't know, the Newbery Award is given to the best nonfiction writer for juvenile books. Jim spent his childhood growing up in an industrial town a stone's throw away from New York City. Jim didn't have much time or interest in reading until a teacher named books that the students were absolutely forbidden to read. Naturally, he rushed out to see what all the fuss was about. Jim then read the forbidden book and kept on reading. And as they say, he could read anything he got his hands on after that point. He attended Rutgers University and did graduate work at Radcliffe College. Jim got a job doing juvenile publishing for a large publishing house. He left working for the publisher to devote himself to his own writing and published his first book, Weird and Wacky Inventions, way back in 1978. Jim lives in Maplewood, New Jersey, in a 100-year-old house with his wife and his two energetic sons, an African water frog, six guppies, and a vast collection of books. We're going to discuss his latest book, The Crossing, about George Washington here on President's Day. Welcome to the show, Jim. How are you today?
Doing fine. Thank you very much, Bill, even though it snowed today.
Oh, well, you guys have had a terrible winter back east. And
big storms, yes.
And I hope that you're digging out from under it. I guess there's some fortune into the fact that this is President's Day holiday. Not too many government people are going to their jobs, so it might make it a little bit easier getting around back in New Jersey.
No traffic whatsoever. No one's out today. I think everyone's just hiding inside from the snow.
And that's a good thing. Well, it is President's Day. I want to turn our attention to your book, The Crossing, about George Washington. And really, when we think about George Washington, he was a superstar among U.S. presidents. I mean, he faced a daunting task even to become a superstar. He had to take a ragtag group of farmers, mold them into an army that eventually defeated the world's greatest superpower of its time, the British Army. Now, how did George Washington, who had very little military experience, get appointed commander-in-chief of the Colonial Army?
Oh, well, a bit of politics were involved. Clearly, in the United States back then, well, in the colonies back then, there were regional rivalries, and people from the north, for instance, up in Boston, wanted a Boston person installed as the commander of the Continental Army. People in the south wanted a southerner. Virginia turns out to be almost in the middle from north to south. And also, George Washington had experience. He was born in the colonies, and the two other people up for being commander were actually British-born people. And so they decided to go with George Washington in part because of his experience in the French and Indian War, but mostly, I think, because they saw Virginia as an important state, but also somewhat close to the North and therefore not so aligned with Southern ideas.
So even in our colonial days, the United States, even before they were the United States, was very much a centrist country, and we chose somebody from the center of the colonies in order to lead the army. I think that that's a very funny story.
He's very much a compromise candidate, you know, but he also wanted that position and showed up at the Second Continental Congress wearing his old Virginia uniform just to show people that he had a certain command presence. And people spoke about him, seeing him and being inspired. You know, he was over 6 feet tall and was quite handsome in his uniform.
Well, and that's interesting. You mentioned the command presence. He was tall for his age, so he engendered a lot of respect, not only from his uniform, but from his height as well. But respect and wanting to do the job are one thing, Jim, but really actually doing the job, that's quite another. So describe how George Washington transformed himself from a gentleman farmer in Virginia to become a brilliant general.
Well, you know, his early training was essentially books, and then he did have experience in the French and Indian War, though not all of it was very positive. He was had a number of defeats. He did not have specific formal training in artillery, in placement of soldiers, and many other things, but he was very focused on keeping his army together. And I told people over and over again, I said his chief accomplishment, especially in that first year, was the fact that despite defeats and despite retreating and despite losing almost 18,000 soldiers to desertion, he managed to keep a group of soldiers together to maintain the presence of an army. And that was the key thing in those opening months.
Well, we're talking to Jim Murphy, everybody, author of the book, The Crossing. We're talking about General George Washington, the father of our country, as we like to say. And it's important, Jim, to come back and drill down on what you just said about keeping the army together. And what a lot of listeners may not realize, unless they're themselves military historians, is how difficult keeping an army together was, because fighting a war in the days of colonial America was completely different than fighting a war today. So talk to us about the seasonalities of war, how difficult it was to keep people from deserting, how difficult it was to keep people together as a group when these citizen soldiers had other family demands trying to pull them away.
Well, the first thing that Washington encountered was the fact that his soldiers, his rank-and-file soldiers, were extraordinarily independent thinkers, and he actually bemoaned the fact that this notion of democracy was rampant in his army because, as we all know, you know, in order for an army to succeed, they have to follow orders even if they don't like those orders. And when he first took over the Continental Army, those were not the kind of soldiers he had. They were very independent. They did things on their own. For instance, when the British had landed in Long Island, he had about 10,000 soldiers, Washington, on Long Island. The British landed 22,000 soldiers. He had no idea that there were that many British there because the leader of his scouts decided to take his 400 men off to look for food. And so Washington had no idea how many British soldiers he was facing. When he went over to visit the troops on Long Island, he discovered that soldiers were wandering through the countryside, shooting wildly at anything they saw, that there was no order or discipline. And that was what he had to deal with in the opening days of the fighting in Long Island. And it did not go well for Washington or the troops.
No, it did not. In fact, your book, The Crossing, describes one of the bleakest times in the American Revolution. We lose the Battle of New York. We lose New York City, which was, even in its day, not the capital city by any means, but one of the prominent cities in the United States or in the colonies at that time. So how did George Washington snatch victory from the jaws of defeat? How did he turn it around?
Well, first, he was very persistent. He wanted to hold his army together, and he would do anything to do it. So as they retreated north, and then they also came back down south and then retreated through New Jersey, and as troops were abandoning him and the cause, his decision was not to become angry and not to blame people. His decision was to encourage the men he had. When they crossed the Delaware into Pennsylvania, His original 22,000 soldiers had shrunk to about 3,000. But guess what? Those were 3,000 people who really wanted to be there and would obey his orders no matter what he said. And those are the troops that he brought back over to fight the first battle of Trenton.
Now, we're talking to Jim Murphy, everybody, author of the book, The Crossing. And, Jim, you've got the phones ringing. We've got Gary on the line who has a question for you. Hi, Gary. How are you today?
I'm fine.
Good. Thanks for calling in on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. What question do you have for Jim?
Well, about George Washington, after his second term, he wrote a paper about when he was going to leave office. And it's a very great document because he talks about foreign policy and how we should be equal with the countries as well as ourselves when we do things for the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think he's kind of had like a foresight of what future presidents should be as, you know, presidents for our nation. I think it's a document that's, I don't know if he knows about it, but there's a document. It was like, it's in the references of the libraries, but I was wondering if he knew anything about if he had ever read that document about Washington.
Well, specifically, I've read portions of that document, yes, but what you said resonated because, clearly, and we all know this, Washington was our first president. He served two terms, and he did a lot of interesting things during those two terms. You know, he was cautious, and he took small steps, but he wanted to establish the United States government as legitimate and also as a country to be reckoned with, because once he did that, he knew that he would get respect from other European countries and support, but he also wanted to make sure the British did not come back again and try to, affect a takeover again. So he accomplished many things in those first two seasons, but you know what? One of the great things he did is after two terms, he bowed out, even though people wanted him to stay as president. They admired him. They adored him. They saw him as almost godlike, but he established the notion that two terms was about enough for a president. And that's something that, you know, even though they didn't put in official term limits back then and not until after FDR, if you look at the presidents, they essentially stay in two terms and then they leave. And I think that's one of the great things when you look at other countries around the world where someone is elected to an office, the term is about to run out, and then they decide, well, I'm not going to leave, I'm going to stay, and they stay forever.
Gary, great question. Thank you for calling in. One quick question for you, if I can, please. Of all of our presidents here on President's Day, who do you think is our best president, in your opinion?
Well, I'm going to go with George Washington. I'm a real Washington fan, and I do it for two specific reasons. I think he's the only military person who could have held the army together. Remember, he was commander-in-chief from 1775 to 1783. He held an army together. He fought, as you said, the biggest military empire in the world. He fought them and won. That's number one. Number two, when he left office, he established the idea of term limits, the fact that someone does not rule a country simply because people want him to or he feels like doing it.
Yeah, that's great. All right, Gary, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. Now, Jim, back to you and back to your book, The Crossing. Not all colonialists were revolutionary. In fact, many of them wanted to stay aligned with England for economic and also for political reasons. So really, George Washington was fighting a two-front war. On the one hand, he had to win against the British, which we ultimately did, but also he had to win with the loyalists at home and get them to join over onto his side. So how did George Washington win the propaganda war?
Well, he was very much someone for moderation. He did not believe in persecuting loyalists just because they were loyal to the king and Parliament and Great Britain, and he was very much for, we're going to win this war, but then we're going to absorb them peacefully. There were many people in the colonies who wanted to do away with everyone. Part of that was an ability to seize land, and it happened a great deal in Pennsylvania. And one of the things about him that was so appealing to people is that for all of his strength and all of his vision for the future of America, he also had a very moderate approach to dealing with an enemy.
What do you mean by a moderate approach? You mean with his position on the loyalists and how he was going to incorporate?
Well, he went out of his way over and over again to inform troops that they weren't supposed to attack loyalists unless they were, you know, hostile to them, that they weren't just to go into certain villages that were known to be loyalist strongholds and seize the houses and burn the houses and to drive the citizens off. And he went out of his way over and over again to emphasize that this is a war against Great Britain and its soldiers, not against civilians.
That was a
big thing, because terrorism was a real weapon being used by both sides then, but he was very clear and public about it, too. He made these orders and sent them around often.
And in what ways, Jim, was this sentiment reflected 15 presidents later with Abraham Lincoln and then later with Andrew Johnson as well after the end of the Civil War?
Well, clearly, when the war was turning, when the Civil War was turning and it looked as if the Union armies would prevail, Lincoln set up the apparatus for absorbing the South back in without lots of retribution or you know, monetary fines or anything, or jailing the people. If you really look at what happened, not many people from the South were put in jail simply because they sided with the Confederacy.
Nah.
And that's an amazing thing. And Johnson, of course, took that over and was essentially driven from office because there were enough people around who wanted to make an example of the South, and so he was kind of the victim of Lincoln's policy.
We're talking to Jim Murphy, author of the book The Crossing: How George Washington Saved the American Revolution. And Jim, what do you want readers to take away from reading The Crossing?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, this is a book aimed at younger readers, though I do know some adults who have read it and enjoyed it. But what I did here is I brought in and talked about some of George Washington's flaws and the fact that he wasn't a military expert and he made mistakes. But I want them to come away with the notion that you learn from your mistakes, and that's what George Washington did, and that's why I focus this very carefully on George, his personality, and how he managed to keep his army going despite problems he faced. And the truth is, I remember getting criticized once. Someone said, "How dare you say something like that about our first president?" And I said, "But I think it actually makes him even a bigger hero, the fact that he, like a lot of us, have to overcome problems and have to overcome our own insecurities and self-doubts, and he did."
That's great. We've been talking to Jim Murphy, everybody, author of the book, The Crossing: How George Washington Saved the American Revolution, here on President's Day. Jim, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about this book or any of the 35 other books that you've written, where would you direct them to go?
Well, my website is jimmurphybooks.com.
jimmurphybooks.com. There you'll find all of the information about Gary and this book, The Crossing, and all of the other books that he's written. Jim, thank you so much for your being a guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank
Take
you very
care.
Much.